Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here to share with you this evening, and I guess a couple more times following this. I'm from Seastead, from Lancaster County. My wife Rebecca is along with me. We have five children, four sons and a daughter, and our sons are married, and we have 19 grandchildren, and we enjoy children. And have watched children grow and still watch children grow and interact with children. I've taught school for 40 years. I've also been, I'm working currently for Christian Light, working on some curriculum development projects, and have had opportunity of also teaching in summer term at Faith Builders in the last 25 years. And one of the classes that I've been teaching most of those years is in child development. There's always something to learn, and we'll be thinking about children and about the rising generation. As Brother mentioned about trees, it's fascinating how something so small can get so big, and what happens in those early years is formative for the later years. And so as we think of nurturing children, there's something that's very basic about this. In many senses, it's you could say simple wisdom. The principles of rearing children are the same world over, have been for ever since Adam and Eve raised their children. However, as Christians, we take particular interest in how we raise our children, but there are principles, and there are also unique things. I'll just refer to two general scriptures. So one of them is the familiar one out of Ephesians 6:4. The King James says, "Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." And the Amplified says, "Fathers, do not irritate and provoke your children to anger, nor do not exasperate them to resentment, but rear them tenderly in the training and discipline and the counsel and admonition of the Lord." And so that is a particular principle that applies to all children. And it's possible to do things in a way that actually irritate and provoke children to anger if we do not work with them properly. And there are two words in that are particular. One of them is the nurture, and the other is admonition. Nurture has to do with how we relate to people, how we interact with them, how we care for them, the things we do with them and around them. And the admonition has more to do with the words we speak. The root of admonition is actually monit, which is a word, as in a monologue. And so we speak, but we also do. And so there are principles we'll be talking about. But as we know, every child is different. And this is one of these paradoxes. Life is full of paradoxes, and the older you get, the more you can enjoy the paradoxes of life. Paradoxes are truths that run on parallel tracks, and they're both true. And they seem, in some ways, maybe to be contradictory, but they're not. And so one of these paradoxes is that there are principles that apply to all children. There's something very similar to all children, and yet every child is an individual. And requires some individual, specific understanding for that child. In that case, I think of the case in Judges when Samson's parents were told they're going to have a special child. And the Manoah, Samson's father, asked whether the angel couldn't come again. The angel came and spoke to his wife one time. And so the angel came the second time. And Manoah asked the angel, he said, "Now," this is in Judges 13:12. Manoah said, "Now let thy words come to pass. How shall we order the child, and how shall we do unto him?" And so the angel gave them some specific direction for that particular child. In that case, he was to be a Nazarite and so forth. And so there are those situations with individual children. Those of you who've raised several children know that you can have one child, the next one comes along, and you might think you know something about child rearing, and then another one comes along, and then you wonder whether you knew anything, because this second one's an individual. And so, they're all individuals, but there's something different. And so we'll look at some of those things together. Now, what I'd like to do is I'll lay out a bit of an outline here where we go. I'll be apparently speaking four times this evening, tomorrow evening, and then Sunday morning and Sunday evening. And so I'll be speaking the first two times on the first two stages of childhood. There are, in general, there are three stages of childhood. The one starts out with infancy, the time when a child doesn't know the right hand from the left, doesn't know which ends up or down. And this era basically lasts till about, in our times, we'd say the preschool years, up till about age five or so. There's an era in there that there are particular characteristics of children in this age. And then that's what we'll look at this evening. And then tomorrow evening, we'll look more at the childhood age from about age 6 through 12. Or 13 would be the elementary school age, the childhood age. And then on the last evening, Sunday evening, we'll look at the youth age from about age 13 up until the threshold of adulthood, up until the teen years. So those would be the three ages we'll look at. And then on Sunday morning, we'll look at a particular topic on helping children come to faith, or how we encourage our children to grow in faith through the years of childhood. And so, looking this evening, you have a handout that the heading says, Laying a Solid Preschool Foundation. And so the preschool, in our culture, the preschool years up through about age five, it's amazing that what happens in those years is truly, truly foundational in many, many ways. In fact, there are some over the years, some people, like I think it's been said that the Catholic people over the years would have said, give me a child until he's five, and they can kind of have them for life. What happens in those 5 years is exceptionally formative in many ways. And we can look at this in one way we can see this is when a child in these early years, when a child is, and the social services people will tell you this, when a child is neglected or abused in those early years, and even in the years before they remember, it affects them for life. And if they have difficulties in these early years, when they get to school, the school teachers are struggling with these issues, dealing with these issues all through the school years because of what happened before they ever came to school. Now, the flip side of that is that if children are trained in the nurture and admonition of the Lord in these years, that also bears fruit for life. Our daughter worked in a preschool program in Baltimore for 5 years and with two-year-olds. And it's fascinating working with two-year-olds. I reminded her, you know, these children will probably never won't remember you, because most of us don't remember, can't call to mind things that happened before we were about 3 years old. But yet, the things that happened in those years are formative. And on the positive side, when there are good influences in a child's life in these early years, there's a benefit, a huge benefit in the later years. One of the characteristics of this age we're talking about, we'll be looking at this evening, the preschool age, in general, in these first two, three, probably 4 years, If you would look out the window and see a toddler, a two-year-old, walk out there by himself or by herself, one of your first responses would be to look around and see who is watching out for that child, right? If you look out the window and you see a two-year-old wandering and you wouldn't see any other person around, you would feel responsible to go to the window to see what's going on, who's watching over that child. And if nobody is in sight, you would probably feel responsible to keep an eye on the child or maybe to go out and lead them in or somewhere, because a two-year-old out in the middle of there, especially close to the road, is not capable of knowing where to go, what to do. Obviously, if they're home and they're alone, that's a different story. But they do not have the ability, the discretion to understand things like traffic or where to go or not to walk into a pond and so on. And so the age we're talking about here is that one of the things that characterizes this age is this child needs to be under somebody's supervision all the time. And we just think how common sense that is. A two, a one, a two, a three-year-old. Somebody always knows where that person is and watches out for them. Now, some characteristics of this age. The heart is what we really deal with when we relate to each other, when we teach, when we talk, when we teach children and train children. We're really working with the heart. It's helpful to recognize different parts of the heart. That is really the biblical term. It doesn't matter where the heart is in the body, whether this is seated in your pumping organ or where it is. The point is that the Bible uses the term heart. Give me your heart. The Bible talks about pondering in the heart. The will is seated in the heart. The volition, the intentions are in the heart. It's helpful, though, to recognize some parts of that. And these are all biblical terms. The two parts we think about with young children is the will and also the affections, the feeling, the affections. And then there is also the mind. And with young children, with preschoolers, the two most important things to work with are actually the will and the affections. Now, the mind is part of it, too, but these children are primarily directed by their feelings, by their senses. That's kind of the way they're put together. They feel, and they also will. There's a handout was passed out. I'll be calling attention to a few of these things, and we'll start with the first step here. This talks about in laying a solid foundation. I use the term discipline guidelines. And when I use the word discipline, I'm using that in the term of discipling. When you disciple someone, you guide, you train, you teach, you shepherd, you interact with that person. And the first... In this age, the preschool age, one of the outstanding characteristics of these children, especially the very young ones, is that they're changing very rapidly. Everything changes rapidly. It's amazing if you have grandchildren or little children that you don't see very often, if a couple of months go by until you see them again, and sometimes you shake your head. Oh, no, I just can't imagine. I mean, the last time I saw them, they were just rolling over. Now they're standing. Next time you see them, they're walking. Next time you see them, they're running. Then next time you see them, they're riding a scooter. Then they're riding a bike. And it just, they change. In all aspects, physically, socially, emotionally, spiritually, there's rapid change. And if there is one key problem, one key thing that these little children need to learn, if you could narrow it down to the most important one, it's that there are other people in this world besides you. You are not the center of the world. And your will is not what runs the world. There's a delightful collection of stories in a book called Horse Stories by the Man Who Played with Sticks. I think the title is. Has anybody seen the book? Christian Light sells it. Is there a copy around here anywhere? There's some good stories in there about training ponies. And there's one story about a pony that was trained. This pony, it said he could have been called, I think maybe his name was Will, but they said he might as well have been named Won't, because that's how he acted. You know, I won't. And it's interesting, we sometimes talk about the child turning two. There are certain kinds of behaviors you kind of anticipate when a child turns two. And I remember some of my older sons were distressed at the behavior of a younger sibling when this child was two. And I remember telling them, you know, you were two one time, and you had your turn to be two. And everybody has that privilege of being two for a year. And it's okay to be two. And one of the key presentations of this, of a certain age with most children, is simple defiance. And one of the key focuses is to establish rulership over the child's will. If you can compare this to training a horse, you know, a horse that has a lot of energy, a pony that has a lot of energy, and is willing to really put himself into something and really has spark and has energy. It's a valuable animal, and there's a lot of potential there. But the potential, I say potential, but a horse that cannot be trained to stop when it's time to say stop, to go when it's time to stay go, to turn right when it's time to turn right, to stand still when it's time to have the bridle put on, to run hard when it's time to run hard, and walk when it's time to walk, that horse really can't be used. He really cannot be used. A horse cannot be trained is useless in terms of getting any work done. There's also another delightful story about Tootle. Tootle was a little, it's an old story in the Golden Book about a little engine. Anybody remember Tootle? And Tootle had many things he had to learn. He had to learn to go slowly around curves and not to spill if he's pulling a passenger car, to not spill the people's coffee. But the most important, and to stop for a red flag, but the most important thing Tootle had to learn was to stay on the tracks. You must get 100% A+ in staying on the tracks. You must. You must never, ever, ever go off the tracks. And as you recall the story, Tootle did venture off the tracks one day, and he had a very fascinating experience. He was able to, pick some daisies. He was able to do some things he couldn't do on the track. And that evening, the oiler noticed that there were some things on Tootle's cow catchers, some daisies and some things there that he knew didn't come from being on the track. And this happened a couple days in a row. And so they trained Tootle by having a whole lot of people go out all with red flags. And they hid behind all the bushes. So the next day when Tootle got off the track, why, every time he started in a certain direction, a red flag popped up from behind the bush, so he couldn't go that way, and he did obey the red flags. He couldn't go this way, couldn't go this way. Finally, he looked back towards the track, and there was a green flag. And so he went back and got on the track, and he learned to stay on the tracks. And he learned that on the tracks, this is my words now, there's freedom on the tracks. And he learned to be a good engine, staying on the tracks. And eventually he got 100% A+ on staying on the tracks no matter what. Now, that does illustrate the the absolute importance of establishing rulership over the will. Parents are in a position of authority, God-given authority, in a position to give direction. When you're put in a position to give direction, it's like maybe you have the authority to direct traffic. And so if you hold up the red flag, the traffic needs to stop. And if you say go, they go. And it's not about who you are as a person. It's not about how smart you are, how old you are, what you know, or what you've studied, or what you learned. If you're in that position to direct traffic, you simply direct traffic. I like to use the illustration of the traffic light. When the traffic light, so you go down the road, and sometimes you come along, and there's a light there, and the light says no. We call that a red light. It says no, don't go now. So you stop, and after a while, it says yes. We call that a green light. Then you go. And most people learn to not get upset at a traffic light. They don't usually argue with the light when it turns red. Now, people don't like no red lights necessarily, but it's because maybe they're late to work or whatever. But they don't usually, if they're in the sane mind, actually get upset with that light itself. It's just saying no and it's saying yes. And there's a difference between, on your paper I have noted here, train the will from willfulness to willingness. When a person is willful, he simply wants to do things in the way he wants to do them because it's the way he wants to do them. It isn't necessarily based on what the thing is or how good it is. For example, if a game is going to be picked to play, it might be one that you yourself might have picked yesterday. Maybe you actually enjoyed that game. But because today somebody else picked it and you didn't pick it, you might say, no, don't want to play that. It has nothing to do with the game and how much you enjoy the game. It's simply because I didn't have the say in whether this happens or not. Or it might be some kind of food that you're offered. And maybe it's food you actually like. Maybe it's a chocolate chip cookie, but and you normally like them. But since you didn't choose it, but it was offered, you might say, no, don't want that. And this could very well be illustration of willfulness. Willfulness is simply set on my own way. And a child has to experience having the will submitted. A will that's not submitted is kind of jerking the child around, is in control of the child. And a child whose will is submitted, has the experience of having the will under control. And that is so important. The will is a fascinating thing. God actually wants us to use our will. And we want children to use their will. And it's amazing. You can tell when somebody chooses to put himself into something. When a child puts himself into cleaning up his plate, it doesn't take very long for it to happen. When they want to put away the toys, it doesn't take very long for them to be put away if they do it with a will. And so the will is a fascinating thing. We do not want to destroy it. We do not want to crush it. We actually want the child to use the will, but the will has to be able to be controlled. And a child whose will is not trained to be under the direction of the parent will also then not be able to control it himself or submit it to God. And so with children, external controls are obviously needed. And Number five on your handout, teach children that no means no. No is a simple word, and it's a word that it's kind of a statement of, and almost a statement of fact. So will we do this now? No. A bit like the red light. And there's a, and no should be, should simply be, mean no. We, you know, we won't have more dessert now, or we won't play that game this evening, or we won't finish this before we have devotions, whatever. No, well, it's a way of giving direction. And one thing you may have noticed is there are always trends, and there's a big difference between simply saying no and then giving direction what we're going to do, or saying no because and then filling in the blank. When we feel compelled to say no because, now we are not really saying, we're not really giving direction. We are, in a sense, kind of opening ourselves up for a discussion or a debate or an argument. No, because we have enough. Well, actually, I'm still hungry. Oh, well, then we have to come up with a, if we say no because, it almost, it's that we have to have a reason that's strong enough to substantiate doing this that's separate from my decision. And when a person is in authority and giving direction, why, in many cases, he doesn't have a logical or a moral, or he doesn't need a logical or a moral or a biblical reason to do what he's doing. He's simply giving directions, because we can't do two things at one time and we can't do everything. And so sometimes we do this and sometimes we do that. So I don't want to belabor this, but this is such a significant point. One of David's sons was Adonijah, one of his sons. It says his father had never displeased him. He apparently always got his own way. And so, yes, it was Adonijah. His father never displeased him. So a couple things to keep in mind are that sooner or later, with young children, sometimes you can manipulate them, you can redirect their attention into something else. And there may be a time for that. But that simply, like you say, kicks the ball down the road. That simply puts off meeting the child's will. Sooner or later, the time will come that you'll have to meet the will directly, because you can't have two people in charge and somebody has to decide what we'll do at the particular time. Looking at your outline, so train the will. Train the child to obey. And that leads to self-control, and that brings cheerfulness. A child who has the experience of the parent actually wants the child's best. At heart, you want the best for the child, and so there's a time to work, there's a time to play, there's a time to sing, there's a time to be silent, and children don't know what those times are. And parents need to make some of those decisions. And a child who fits in with life, I like to say, when it's time for the sun to come up in the morning, God doesn't say, is it okay if the sun comes up now? It comes up. And when it goes down, it goes down. And we learn to fit our lives with reality. This is the way life works. And when we submit to that, there's a wonderful freedom. There's a wonderful freedom. We can sleep in the nighttime and work in the daytime. And it's like staying on the tracks. A train is very functional on the tracks. A car is very functional on the road. You get a car off the road, a train off the tracks, things don't go well. And so being in order. All right, well, moving on. I'll go down this outline here and just call attention to some of these. Model expected behavior. Behavior is actually learned. Children do learn their behavior. They learn it in many ways. They learn what patience looks like. They learn to be impatient or patient. They learn to be kind or unkind. And one of the ways is, one of the most powerful ways children learn is by modeling. It's amazing how by example you can do something one time and a child can watch and they can do it. There's a story of the child who for the first time saw another child in a store somewhere throw a fit, got down the floor and screamed and kicked around his legs. And this was rather intriguing. The child had never seen this before. And so that evening at home, he wanted something and parents said no. So he lay down on the floor and tried to jerk his legs a little way. He saw the child in the store do it, and he wasn't quite sure how this comes off, but he did a pretty good job just seeing it one time. And the parent was somehow able to extinguish that behavior after the first time. Now, that's an illustration of how a child can learn something unhealthy by seeing it one time. But the point is that things like waiting in line, shaking hands with people, the way you greet people, just the way you act. Remember that the little boy is following you and they will copy you. You know, Simon says, the copycat. It's one of the fastest ways to learn. Number three, train your child to hear your voice. Sometimes children say, I didn't hear you. Well, that probably doesn't mean the eardrums didn't vibrate. It probably doesn't mean that your voice wasn't loud enough. Probably eardrums did vibrate. The message did get to words got to the brain. But they did not hear in the sense of listening and responding. And in fact, they can do very well at tuning things out. It's amazing what children can hear. I've taught in a classroom already where there was a clock system, a bell system, and about 5 seconds before the bell would ring, there'd be a little bit of a clunk in the clock. You had to be really quiet to hear it. But it's amazing how children could hear that. The bell was much louder, but they were able to hear that little clunk 5 seconds before the bell went and respond to it by being ready to go. And so they can train themselves to hear the slightest sounds. And so you need to train your child to hear your voice. Out of all the noises in the world, they can be trained to hear you and to obey promptly. It is appropriate to speak to children to give direction in the imperative mood. Children should not use that on their parents. The imperative mood, a little bit of grammar here, is simply sit down now, or close your book, or fold your hands. The simple statement of direction. And this is not bossing children around. This is not throwing your weight around. It's simply giving directions. It's time to fold your hand, close your eyes, and we will pray. And if we always preface that with, is it okay? Are we ready to do this now? Asking the question as though there's an option here. Don't be afraid to be a director, to simply give direction. Consistency is one of the most important things for parents and teachers. Consistency, it's amazing how powerful reinforcing behaviors are. And if 1 out of 10 times if a child begs for something, if they get it 1 out of 10 times, it's worth it. It's worth begging for. And I'm not saying children shouldn't beg for things, but for a good thing anywhere you ask for them. But if there's something you really want to not have done or something you really want to do, consistency is one of the most important things to follow. And so, for example, if it's something we're supposed to do properly, like carrying your plate to the kitchen sink after a meal, well, it needs to be done every time, not 5 times out of 8, but every time. And the more consistent we can be, the less hassle there is in training. One more comment on the teaching that no means no. Don't expect these young children, we're talking about the preschool years, don't expect their logical understanding of things to drive their behavior. And so, for example, if the child takes somebody else's toy, if they pest somebody, or if they do something unkind to somebody or hurts them, there's nothing wrong with telling them that child, your brother doesn't like when you take his toy. But sometimes we might find ourselves saying, how many times must I tell you, or didn't I tell you that before, or do you think they like that? The assumption seems to be that if the child remembers that the other child won't like this, then he won't do it. Well, it would be nice if we would remember that, but remember, these children primarily they're impulsive, and they do things without thinking. And so this requires training. And sometimes if we expect them to go on what they know, we end up nagging them. And let me just remind you, even with adults, we know that when it comes to training ourselves to do things properly, we don't always think first. We know very well, for example, that overeating or eating too many sweets or other things that aren't good for our health are not good for us. And yet we sometimes take that second helping, or we sometimes do something that is not best for our health. Somebody could easily say to us, how many times must I tell you? Don't you know that this isn't good for you? And yet we do it, even as adults. We don't necessarily act on our understanding or our logic. If we don't always do that, what do we expect of two-year-olds? And so it requires training, reminding them to not letting them do it, but don't assume that they'll operate based on their understanding. It's important to understand age-appropriate behaviors and emotions. These children will have certain fears of the dark, of storms, being alone, fear of failing, fear of rejection. And it's important to understand that and not make light of it. With these little children, what seems nothing to us, what doesn't seem big to us, is big to them. And understand their behavior. Encourage children. These children need to know when they reach your expectations. They do need encouragement. They need blessing. Enoch had this testimony that he pleased God. And it's so easy for us to point out when children don't do well or what they should be doing, and then to just be silent when they do well. And so it is important to let them know when they are living up to expectations and bless them at times, bless them sometimes for doing well. The rod has its place for defiance, for foolish, thoughtless things, but don't expect it to. There's probably two problems with the rod. The one is if it's never used, if you try to, there's a time when if the rod is never used on a young child, while you can frustrate you and the child, you can end up nagging and reminding, and this goes on and on, when sometimes it just clears the air and gives peace and clears the air, and we're ready to move on. But the flip side, this is the paradox, there's a time when the use of the rod can just frustrate the child, and if we expect the rod to do everything, that it does not take the place of consistency, of good example, of training from day to day, of just requiring a child to do something. Moving to another category, I mentioned the feelings, the affections. Children are feelers, and they they're very much, it's fun to watch them feeling. I'm not sure when the last time is that you laughed for the sheer pleasure of being alive and awake and hearing the birds sing. But children are so in tune and can enjoy life so much that sometimes you hear a child laugh simply from the sheer joy of playing, something they're playing with or something they hear. They're very, very much in tune in a sensory way with the world around them. They play, they build, they run, they climb, and they are very, very much feelers. And this is appropriate. And affection is one of those powerful ways to interact with children. It's actually how you start out with an infant. You hold that child. You talk to the child. You look in the eyes. You make the sounds like you make with an infant. And there's an interaction there. There's a feeling. And children have feelings that come and go very quickly. They have surprise, they have fears, they have scares, they have frustrations. They're trying to do something and they can't, it doesn't work, so they kick it. Or they're frustrated with something, so they might rip it. Or the anger might come and, you know, it might go, it might come in 10 seconds. It's there and then it's gone, impatience. And so children are feelers, and part of the training we have with children is to train them how to handle their feelings, how to respond with their feelings. It's okay to be excited and to be happy, but you don't throw things across the room. Teach children to care. One of the ways of getting a child to care beyond himself is to care for an animal, a pet, a plant. It gives them to interact with another living thing. To encourage children to try. This is very much a feeling thing. Encourage a child when something is new. Try it. You can do that. And the excitement, the blessing of trying something difficult and then being able to do it is a formative experience in a child's life, whether it's jumping over a mud puddle, whether it's threading a bead on a shoestring, whether it's sewing something, baking something, trying something new, tasting something that he didn't taste before. The very act of trying something is much more important than that immediate thing, because as we go through life, we have to attempt many new things. And the child who's encouraged to try when he is younger is then willing, when he gets in school and he has to look at something strange, has to pick up a pencil and copy letters and work with things he's never worked with before, if he has the attitude of being able to try, that carries him a long way. The affections. A child should find rest. In fact, there's a book called Rest, Play, Grow. That's the title of the book. And the author points out, and it's a biblical concept, that when a child is secure in the love, the acceptance of parents, and when somebody is in charge in the home or wherever the child is, when the babysitter or someone's in charge and things are under control, a child is able to relax and be free to play. Now, if a child is tense, upset, frustrated, they're not really free to play and to grow. A child who is free to play is relaxed, and children should play naturally, especially preschoolers. Moving on to social development, getting along with others, teaching responsibility. And it can be very, very simple ways in the home. It can be simple household chores, whether it's helping with dishes or garbage or trash or putting the room away. But responsibility, there's something wonderful about responsibility. This is actually mine to do. It's something that actually has to be done. Maybe the floor has to be swept up with a dustpan and brush after a meal, and you know, a very young child can do that. Somebody has to do it. And if it's your job to do, you're actually contributing something to the family. There's a blessing in accepting and being given a responsibility that actually isn't just invented for you to do to see if you can do it, but actually has to be done. Learning to share. Learning to relate to adults. You will bless your child if you take the initiative. Some children need help, more help with this than others, but to shake hands with adults, to look them in the eye, and of course, the other, on the flip side, as an adult, when you meet a parent with children, do you notice the child? It's amazing how much influence that has if there's a 2 or 3 year old there and you shake hands with the father or mother and you also notice the child and say hello to the child. The child recognizes, oh, apparently I exist. Apparently I can be seen. Apparently I'm significant enough for people to notice me. Relationships with adults start in very, very simple ways, simply from saying hello to being able to sit in somebody's lap, to answer. When it's time to say hello to Uncle Pete, and a child actually, most children can say their names. And when you ask them to, somebody asks you how old you are or what your name is, the child who's trained that when somebody asks you that, you answer in an articulate voice that can be heard. Sammy, that little seemingly insignificant response to an adult question is a very important little formative thing in the child's life. There are many things like this that are small, but they all they're all formative. Children who have experiences away from home. I can think back to being a child in preschool years. I remember being away overnight in my cousin's house. And there's something interesting, a little bit scary about that, because the aunt and uncle don't quite do things the same way in their home that you do in your home. There's something just a little bit different. But yet, it's comfortable because I know them and my cousins were there. But that kind of experience is an enriching experience and just stretches the child a little bit. Encourage play. I could talk for a long time on this, and I might in the next category, but children need to play. And I don't know what all is involved in it today, but a lot of children today don't seem to know how to play. And one of the times that children can make choice is when it's time to play. Some parents seem to, it's probably some kind of pop psychology idea that you should train your children to make choices. And so there, you hear this constant litany of, I hope I'm exaggerating a little bit, but do you want your cereal in the bowl first and then the milk? Or do you want the milk and then the cereal? Do you want the spoon on the right side of your plate or the left side of your plate? Do you want your spoon upside down or do you want it in your hand? Should you sit on the left side of daddy or the right side of daddy? And on and on and on all day, giving the child all these questions, do you want it this way or that way? Raising questions that really oughtn't to be raised because they're just simple things and you just do them. But then when it comes time for a child to actually make choices, the child seems to be unable to make the choice. When it's time to go play, now you can go play. And you could play with blocks, you could play with your dogs, you could play outside, you could play, there's maybe 20 different things you could play. You know, go play. And when it's time for a child to actually use his own volition, his own will, his own choice to go play, sometimes they feel helpless, can't do this. And they must be played with all the time, or they don't know how to play. And so if you see that happening, make sure your children can know. And sometimes you might actually have to show them something. Maybe they need to be shown to stack blocks or whatever. I heard a father say the other year that his children were out. They didn't seem to know what to do out in the lawn. And he had them, I think they played house or something. He showed them how they could do something. How you could have your corner here and she'll have her corner there. And they kind of enjoyed that. And then the next day they did it on their own. He wasn't involved. But it seemed like they couldn't spontaneously do that on their own. So encourage a whole variety of play. In moral development, I'll talk more about this tomorrow, but teach respect for others and teach good manners. Teach obedience, truthfulness. I recall a story when I was a child. These things do happen. My sister and I went along with my parents one time to visit some old people, and there weren't any other children there, so probably some cousins of my mother. So anyway, in another room they had a box with some toys in. Some of these were worn out things, and there was my sister and I each picked something out that we thought was pretty nice. Mine was a broken piece out of a toy car. It had some gears in. It wasn't really a car. Anyway, we went trotting into the living room and asked these people, in the presence of our parents, whether we could have these and take them along home. And of course, they respond, sure, yeah, you may have them. You may take them home. But our parents immediately said, no, you don't ask to take things home from other people's homes. And so we went back and played, and we had this little discussion between ourselves, and we reasoned that they actually said we could take them home. So we did. We took them home. We did not let our parents see us in the car, but we took them along home. And probably sometime the next day, we were playing with these things, and of course our parents saw us. And so that's the one time that something like this happened. And so these people lived about 20 miles away. So the next morning, my father took my sister and I, we got in the car and we went on a drive and we went back to this place. Well, I assume there was a phone call made. But anyway, we pulled in the driveway. My father didn't get out of the car. He just sent us into the house and we went walking in that long walk, went up to the door, and the lady came to the door and opened the door, and we gave these things back, and we were told what to say. We said we were sorry. I barely remember what I said. And went back home, and that was that. We were not scolded. We were not spanked, but as you can see, I remember it to this day. And that's part of my conscience. Children develop a conscience. Your conscience is that inner, there's the story of the old American Indians. They said it's like a triangle in your chest, and when you do something wrong, it turns and it's sharp, it hurts. But if you do something wrong often enough and it keeps turning, after a while the corners wear off and it doesn't hurt so much anymore. And consciences can be developed improperly. And so children can think that what's okay isn't, and what isn't okay is. They can have wrong ideas of what is okay and what isn't. And in this case, why, as you saw, our little reasoning was they actually said we could have them, but our parents' word trumped their word, and we were not obeying our parents. So it was beside the point. We didn't discuss whether or not a parent said we could take it along home. We only discussed whether or not they said we could take it home. And so there are opportunities along the way as these children grow up to teach what's right, and opportunities will arise. spiritual development, read Bible stories, teaching the love of God. As I grew up, I remember believing that God loved me. And I know children get different ideas, and it's interesting how they get the ideas. Some children grow up thinking God's angry with them, or that they have to do certain things, or God will strike them down. I never felt that way growing up. I knew God loved me, and I knew that I knew it's important to do what's right. And I recall doing things that I knew were wrong, but I had to ask for forgiveness, but I knew that God loved me. I'll call your attention to the back of the sheet that I passed out. These are some specific things to do along the way, and I'm not going to, some of these are self-explanatory, but there's a list here that you can look over if you have preschoolers. And as you look at this list and consider the kinds of activities that help children develop, why, you can ask, are these things happening? Now, all of us have to work in some ways of keeping things in balance. We tend to do things, some things come more easily with us, for us, than others. And so there might be something on this list that maybe rarely or ever happens. Other things might happen very often. So one way you can use this list is to just do a bit of a self-evaluation for your own home or with your own children and see whether or not any of this happens, whether maybe some things could happen more or some things maybe less. If I were going to suggest one particular thing to do with your children, it would be read to them. There's something about gathering the children around and reading aloud that is a formative experience. Obviously, you want to read worthwhile material Bible stories, but then there are many kinds of things to read. But when you read aloud together, you're having a shared experience. You're all hearing it at the same time. And you actually are doing something together. There's something much more important than just hearing the story. And, of course, if children are old enough, they can be involved in reading also. And then number two, engaging in conversation. Use the opportunities you have along the way. This would probably be what's referred to in Deuteronomy 6, along the way. Sometimes this is literal, driving down the road, or washing the dishes, or meal times, or just at impromptu times. Talk with them about what is going on. Don't make lessons, with classes out of this necessarily, but just talking about things. Maybe telling stories, maybe talking about what you're doing occasionally, or asking questions. And have them practice storytelling. It does the child good to tell you, if he went along with Daddy to the store and comes home, have him tell you about his experience. Recounting the experiences that you had is helpful. It helps you to articulate. It helps you to summarize things. Just engaging them in conversations. There's a certain age that children ask why. Why? And that's a stage, too. It's a helpful stage. And remember how old they are and answer according to the age level. Number 14, following directions. The simple game of Simon Says. Who knows how to play Simon Says? Simon Says, stand up. It requires, just think about what that game requires. It requires focus. It requires you to pay attention. Because if Simon says it, then you do it. If Simon didn't say it, you don't do it. So you've got to be alert and pay attention. It also involves taking directions from somebody else, taking direction. And then, of course, it could involve motor skills. And so there are some simple games like this that have been around for generations that are very, very valuable. There are some things that teachers will bless you for if children come to school having these things in place, such as the ability to count, maybe count to 20 or count to 30. And if you put down numbers and step on the numbers or know the sequences or understand simple things like more or less. And then number 19, memorizing things. The act of memorizing is valuable for the mind, for the brain, of course, for the future. Memorizing rhymes. When children memorize simple sayings like Hickory Dickory Dock, some of those nursery rhymes, it's not about the content. It's about recognizing sounds, hearing sounds, distinguishing sounds. It's also about articulation, being able to use your voice. There's something significant happens when you recite or rapidly read or recite some of these sayings. And then another thing, when the children are young, teach them to sing. And it's very difficult if a child goes to school being a monotone or not having found a singing voice. It's difficult to teach that in the classroom. And so having the child match a tone and being able to sing instead of do, re, mi, singing do, re, mi, instead of do, re, mi, can the child match a tone? And then there is the body movements. Make sure that your children learn to hop, skip, jump, throw a ball, catch a ball, and then also fine motor skills, tracing, cutting, gluing. There's a whole host of activities, and these are things that help a child prepare for what's later in life. These children at this age are very, very active, and it's a very fun age to be with, and every child comes to us fresh from the hand of God, and these children, in a few short years, will be adults, and what happens in these years is very, very formative. And there are some, children do have unique individual, there's some individual things about them to understand, and yet there are general things to understand. So enjoy working with your children. Establish rulership over the will, because when they learn to submit to what is, then they can actually exercise self-control. And if you do not learn to subject yourself to someone else's direction, you can't exercise self-control either. It makes problems for later in life. And remember the affections, the feelings. And one of the most powerful, I believe it was Andrew Murray that says that, you know, habits precede principles. One of the most important things for these children to do is to develop habits. Good habits. Habits grow. You do something they used to say for 40 days and you've established a habit. And when we do things in the proper way, because we're trained, because it's a habit, it has a way of forming our attitude, forming our conscience, forming our thinking. Habits are formative. And so that's one of the primary ways of working with these children to develop their habits and training. Let's sing a song together. In closing, we'll sing Children of the Heavenly Father, 393. 393. Oh, children of the Heavenly Father, safely in His bosom gather, nestling bird nor star in heaven,
such a refuge ne'er was given. God is all doth tend and nourish, in his holy courts they flourish. From all evil things he spares them, in his mighty arms he bears them. Neither life nor death shall ever from the Lord his children sever. Unto them his grace he showeth, and their sorrows all he knoweth.
Verse 5.
Though he giveth or he taketh, God his children ne'er forsaketh. Is the loving purpose solely to prepare them pure and holy.
Let's stand for prayer.